and beer and spirit tastings on Sundays from 3 to 5. Information at thecorkscrew.com.
Fasten your seatbelts. We're ready to go.
WILL takes you on a journey of discovery every day, but our engine can't run without your financial support. And the goal is to raise $2.1 million by June 30th.
Are we there yet?
The fuel gauge shows our tank is 76% full.
Help power the programs you value with a contribution online at willpledge.org or call 217-244-9455. Thanks.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, we have an archive for you in the first hour. Then I do want to mention again, in hour number two, we'll be here live and taking calls. Mae Barenbaum will be with us. She's an entomologist. When she is on the program, we talk about insects, try to appreciate them for their many and varied forms. So if there's something that you've seen and you're looking for an identification or you'd like to just know more about a particular bug, you can call in hour number two. But first, in the first hour, we go back to April for a conversation that we had with journalist writer Ann Hagedorn about her book Savage Peace, Hope and Fear in America 1919. So as you listen, do keep in mind that during this first hour, we'll not take calls. In this hour, we will look back to a particular moment in American history, one that I think our guest would argue has not perhaps gotten the kind of attention that it should. This was a time when Americans were worried by, perhaps one would say consumed by, worries over terrorism, racial tension, the issue of immigration, the intrusion of government into their private lives. All of these, I'm sure that you will say, very current concerns, and perhaps we could be talking about any time within the last couple of years, but the time that we are talking about is the year 1919, that year that comes in between the end of World War I and the beginning of the Roaring Twenties. Our guest for the program is Ann Hagedorn, and she is the author of a newly published book. It's just come out. The title of her book is Savage Peace, Hope and Fear in America, 1919. And the book is published by Simon & Schuster. And if you're interested, you can seek it out. It's been out here officially, I think, for just a couple of weeks. She's spending some time now traveling around talking about the book and is joining us by phone. And we're pleased that she could be with us on the program. Let me tell you just a little bit more about her. She is an award-winning author and journalist. She's been a staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. She's also written for other publications, including The Washington Post. She taught writing at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, also at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Her other books include Wild Ride, Ransom, and Beyond the River. And she, as I say, she's joining us this morning by telephone. Ms. Hagedorn, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on, David.
We certainly appreciate it. I'm not exactly sure where to start because there is so much going on at this time, and it is, you know, I think I suppose one should be a little careful about drawing parallels between one time and another. But the fact is that the list of concerns, the things that people worried about and argued about and talked about then, so closely parallels what we're talking about now. It really does seem remarkable. And I don't know if there are all that many other times that you can draw those kinds of lines, but you can certainly do that now.
That's right. And I have to say that my only regret with this book, authors always have little regrets here and there. I have one big one, and that's that I didn't ask for a two-book contract or three books. I mean, what happened in 1919 was so intense and so relevant to our world now, but also relevant to how we think today. I mean, I kind of I could have filled two or three volumes and still made it tight and fast-moving, but a lot of what happened in that year shaped the way we think, shaped our world today. And we all know that about the Paris Peace Conference, right? I mean, that's the association with 1919. But everybody, I think of it as a missing page in history when I'm thinking of America in 1919, because everyone thinks of Paris, Woodrow Wilson, the League of Nations. But what happened in America was very instrumental in terms of the events shaping, like I said, our way of thinking now. So it's not just the parallels, but it's also how we approach the events in our own time.
Mm-hmm. So, well, it strikes me that one of the things I find myself thinking about is that if, when you're coming out of a period like World War One, where something was going on that seemed to be all-consuming, that involved the world in that way, that involved such enormous themes, particularly the battle between good and evil on an almost cosmic level, something that was seen as being a transformative kind of event for the world. People thought that way about World War One.
Right.
I suppose they also thought that about World War Two, and maybe they also thought that about the Cold War. And in a sense, that the when you get so bound up in something like that, when it comes to the end, at least when it comes to the end where people sit down and they sign pieces of paper, it doesn't just end.
No, it doesn't. It's a frame of mind. I mean, war is a habit that's hard to break. And one of the things that you see in 1919 is that these structures that were put together as emergency measures during wartime in this country remained. And so I think that's when you were talking about the parallels. The two major parallels between 1919 and now, I mean, I think there are about a dozen of them. They just kept popping up as I was writing the book, which is kind of remarkable. But one, of course, is the debate over the U.S. role in the world. The other is the debate over civil liberties and restrictions of our civil liberties in the name of national security. And one of the things that happened after World War One was that after the armistice, it wasn't like we suddenly lived in a world of peace. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of instability and a lot of fears of the continuing struggle against an enemy. And so the enemy in this country went from being the Germans or German sympathizers, and then right after the armistice, people who might be sympathetic to the Germans at the Paris Peace Conference, Americans who were in favor of leniency to the Germans. I mean, they were considered the enemy. And then we kind of slid into a new era. Somewhere in the beginning of 1919, I try to portray that through a congressional investigation that began with looking into Americans who had sympathized with Germans, and all of a sudden in February 1919, it's Americans who are sympathizing with the Bolsheviks. Mm-hmm. So all suddenly we have a new enemy. So all of that was put into place to protect America during wartime, whether you're talking about laws or the domestic intelligence network. I mean, at the end of World War One, we had the largest domestic intelligence network ever put into place in any country ever in the world, and it was not included 300,000 to 500,000 volunteer spies in various organizations, but some of that, a large portion of that network, was not dismantled, and then it geared up again when we had a new enemy, and by August, when J. Edgar Hoover, a 24-year-old lawyer in the Justice Department, got his new job as the head of the General Intelligence Division, as soon as he was his new job was in place, and he was sort of, you know, becoming more and more powerful that year, toward the end of that year, then he picked up steam, and several others in government, on this fear of the new enemy, Bolshevism. So we really, we were out of the world war, but we had struggles at home, many struggles, including, you know, race riots in 26 cities, and what was it, the labor strikes, an average of about 300 a month. I mean, it was a year of tremendous struggle.
That's, I think, that as you say here, and now you have illustrated, and I think one of the things that's really striking about this time, when we think about points in American history where we were very worried about the threat of communism, right? I'm sure the first thing I suppose depending on your age, the first thing you're going to think about is the Cold War in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And think about that being the signature issue that as soon as World War II ended and the enemy was no longer Germany and the Japanese, then suddenly now the enemy was the Soviet Union. This kind of worry about the threat of communism really gets, there's a continuity here, really gets started right after World War I.
Yeah, definitely. And that was one of the surprises. I mean, there's certain we all know that at the Paris Peace Conference, there was a reshaping of the map of the world, right? I mean, that's how we got Iraq, Iran, the chopping up of the Ottoman Empire. But I really didn't know until I got into the research for this book how many other events occurred in that year that completely shaped that. That's why I consider it the first year of the 20th century, but effectively. But one of them is definitely the Cold War. I mean, not the term, of course. The term came much later, but our relationship with the new Soviet Union was defined that year, you know, by two things. One, and neither of which I knew, and I feel, I mean, it's not an arrogant comment, but I feel like I do know a lot about American history, but these two things I didn't know when I began my research, and they utterly fascinated me. One was that when the armistice occurred, there were still soldiers fighting in North Russia. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. No.
Yeah, and they, most of them, a lot of them came from Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota because I guess the government thought, well, they grew up in the cold, they'll get used to this North Russia. I don't know, but they called them the Polar Bear Expedition. And, you know, here are all these mothers, fathers, wives, children waiting for their, you know, their loved ones to come home, and all of a sudden, in December of 1918, a senator from California, Hiram Johnson, sits down and talks to the head of the Red Cross in Russia, who's back, Raymond Robbins, and finds out that there are still thousands of American soldiers in North Russia who don't even know that the armistice has been signed. So, so that began a big campaign in Congress with this time it was a Republican senator, Hyman Johnson. He was the guy who, during that campaign, coined the phrase "the first casualty of war is truth." That's how we got that word, that phrase. But at any rate, a grassroots movement, you know, emerged from Michigan, from the families. There were protests, and by July of 1919, the soldiers returned. But it was a very interesting debate in Congress because this was a military adventure that had been unauthorized by Congress, and there were people who didn't in Congress who didn't know about it. So that was one of the that combat. We started out under the premise of guarding our supplies in North Russia, and then we ended up in a civil war fighting the Red Army with, you know, fighting next to the White Army against the Red Army. And the Red Army, of course, being the new Bolshevik government, Lenin, right? So that created a relationship, that and the back home, the new enemy being Bolsheviks. But then on top of that, we had something in America called the Soviet Bureau. It was on West 40th Street in Manhattan. And there were 30 to 40 people employed there, and the idea was to create trade agreements with American companies between the Soviet Union, the new Russia, the Soviet Union, and corporate America. And there were, I think I found records of more than 400 companies that had sent representatives and at least 150 that were very seriously working with the Soviet Union because they saw this as a new frontier, new markets. There wasn't any fear mongering. There wasn't. There didn't seem to be a problem. And then A. Mitchell Palmer, who was the Attorney General at that time, and authorized a raid of the Soviet Bureau in June of 1919, and the head of it and the top-level officials from the Soviet Union who were running it ended up, you know, working with lawyers then on to try to defend themselves and to try to get it running again, but it never opened up again. But so those two events, I think, kind of defined. That was, don't you think, kind of the beginning of the Cold War.
Well, let
so
me just...
interesting. It just fascinating. However, Ford sent 286 touring cars to Moscow before that happened, before the end.
Let me just introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in here since the beginning, Anne Hagedorn. She's an award-winning author and journalist. She's written for The Wall Street Journal. Her writing has appeared in other publications, including The Washington Post. She's taught writing at Northwestern, at the Medill School of Journalism there, and also at Columbia University. And we're talking about some of what you will find in her newly published book that focuses on the year 1919 in America. Her book is titled Savage Peace. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. So with some of the material that came with the book, you talk here, and I'm interested in having you talk about Woodrow Wilson. What you say is that you were, before you started into doing the research for the project, that you were really not that interested in Woodrow Wilson, but that as you read more about him, you found him to be one of the most fascinating presidents that you had studied, and maybe one of the most complicated individuals that you ever read about. What do you find so interesting about Woodrow Wilson?
Oh gosh, Savage Peace is a piece of literary nonfiction, right? And so it's interweaving narratives. It has main characters. It's like a novel, and so one of the techniques in that is the interweaving narratives, and one of them is Woodrow Wilson, and told through the eyes of Ray Standard Baker, who was his press secretary at the Paris Peace Conference, and also a journalist who also wrote under the name David Grayson, who was a best-selling author in 1919. Very interesting guy. And Ray Standard Baker just wrote 8 volumes on Woodrow Wilson, an 8-volume biography. I thought at the time, how could he write 8 volumes on this man? And now I understand, because I think it took 8 volumes to try to figure him out, to figure out for Ray Standard Baker to feel satisfied that they understood Woodrow Wilson. You know, the question has always been, did he really believe his ideals of world peace? And that's was he naive and didn't understand the political structures of Europe and what was eventually going to down him, which was just the old world order of nations wanting to acquire territory and control the territory. Did he not understand that that was what World War I was about and what the world was going to continue to be about, or was it a political program of his? Because he appeared to believe that he could achieve the concept of world peace, you know, the war to end all wars. That was one of the slogans. And so his idealism and his ability to speak, I mean, the speeches, you should read some of them, they are unbelievably enthralling. He was so charismatic and so smart. He was a scholar, a historian, very brilliant, but he had these intense blind spots. And that's, you know, those blind spots really are what make 1919 such an intense year at home, because one of the blind spots was definitely race, mm-hmm. race equality. Mm-hmm. You know, Wilson segregated the federal offices after he came to office the first time. I think it was in 1912 or 1913 that he did that, early 1913. And then, but in 1919, the State Department denied African Americans in this country visas to go to the Paris Peace Conference to argue for racial equality worldwide. And Wilson just didn't. First of all, he actually said at one point he thought if Bolshevism was going to rise up in any part of America, it would be in, among blacks. They would be the most vulnerable, which was a horrifying thing to state, and it wasn't true. And people in his own government were doing investigations that eventually proved that it wasn't true at all. The problem in the unrest in African-American communities had to do with Jim Crow discrimination, lynchings, you know, soldiers coming back in uniform, African-Americans having fought the war and then getting lynched. Those were the problems. But he was worried that that African-Americans, if they came to the peace conference, would, first of all, reveal that there was discrimination in his own country. I mean, he was fighting for world democracy, and yet here was a segment of his own country that didn't have a piece of the pie, that did not live in a democracy. It was such hypocrisy. So I think his complexity, his complexity kind of, in a way, is a symbol of the complexity of the year itself at home, because some things were magnificent and gave you visions of a better world, and other things were just kind of left aside. He had blinders on. In fact, I call one chapter blinders.
Yeah. Yeah. We have several callers here who I think would like to come into the conversation, maybe ask some questions, so we want to do that. We're already very close to the midpoint, so again, callers will help us by trying to be brief, and we will get as many as we can, and we'll take them in the order that they came in, and we'll start with someone in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about the U.S. operations in Russia after World War One. My wife has a member of her family who was a Navy doctor and sent back postcards from Vladivostok during that period.
Wow.
You mentioned Northern Russia, and that would have been the east, you know, Pacific coast of Russia. Is that the same thing as you're talking about, or were there operations more in the European part of Russia?
No, it was mostly in North Russia. There were some operations in Siberia, and there were some, but the main operation was around Arkhangel and Murmansk. And the three main cities that come to mind are Vladivostok, then Murmansk, and Arkhangel up in the most northern reaches.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. We'll talk next with someone in Indiana. This is line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I hope this has some bearing. If it doesn't, don't even worry about the question. But you mentioned Henry Ford and the Red and the White Army and that. And a fellow I'm interested in, Sidney Reilly, was involved in that at the beginning, especially when the British didn't send enough troops in from Arkhangel. I was wondering if there's any, you came across him anyway whatsoever. And if so, you know, give me some information about it. Thank you.
Oh, well, I know Sidney Reilly. He was the British. He was a spy, right? Very famous spy. And I came across him in the research, in the Russian research, because of William Bullitt. Do you know the name William Bullitt?
The caller hung up, so I.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. So, no, I don't. I came across the name. I know who he is. But in the primary source materials, this probably will give the caller some peace of mind, I didn't come across anything about him, only in secondary sources. In other words, none of the I based a lot of this book on declassified FBI records, declassified military intelligence, a lot of records in national archives, and never came across anything in the primary sources. But I do know who he is, and in relation to a man named William Bullitt, who was sent to Russia by Wilson in the spring of 1919 to find out what was really going on and to talk to Lenin and find out what was really going on in Russia and whether we should be there or not.
All right. Well, I hope that that's at least an answer in part, and we'll continue. So the next caller is someone in back here in Urbana.
I can put him in volume two.
Okay.
I hope Simon Schuster's listening. Volume two and volume three will include that. No, go ahead.
Right. Next to talk with someone in Urbana, this is line number two. Hello.
Good morning. For your momentous year, I hope you included the passing of Theodore Roosevelt.
Oh, yes.
And also, getting back to the polar bears, author David Shipler found the cemetery for the fallen Americans, I think, at Murmansk.
Oh, okay.
And getting back to Wilson, was this the time that Wilson did the 180-degree turn between against women's suffrage to for women's suffrage?
Yeah, actually, that happened in 1918.
Oh, okay.
But it was definitely in this chunk of time. And he made that turn partly to get them behind him in the war effort. And it's a very interesting thing. And they, some of the suffragists, like Alice Paul, didn't really believe that he was really sincere about that, and so they continued to protest. I think the first day of 1919 includes a huge burning of bonfires on the White House lawn, orchestrated by Alice Paul. But so, yeah, it was definitely during that period of time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. And again, we'll go to, we'll talk with someone in Charleston. This is line number three. Hello.
Hello. I realize that in 1919, Eugene Debs was in prison for his opposition to the World War One.
That's right.
But I'm sure he had influence over the events. So if you could talk a little bit about that, I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah. Eugene Debs went to prison, I think, on April 10th. That year, and he wrote letters from prison to a lot of different people, including Helen Keller. He had a letter exchange with Helen Keller, who is a major figure in the book. Helen Keller, as an aside, came to fame in 1919 because her movie that she helped to produce, write, and star in, Deliverance, about her life, debuted that year. But at any rate, Debs wrote letters to many people while he was in prison, and also he would send a quote a day to the that would be posted in the newspaper, the New York Call. So nobody forgot about Eugene Debs that year. And also, the way he plays into Savage Peace is that he there were three big cases in March of 1919 that Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote opinions on that involved the espionage law that was put into place and still in place during the war and still in place, and this had to do with civil liberties. And that's how we got, it was out of the Eugene Debs decision out of the Supreme Court that Holmes wrote rejecting the appeal, that we got the term clear and present danger. That's the famous clear. That was the Debs case. Was the famous clear and present danger opinion in free speech. But Holmes actually emerges as a hero in Savage Peace. Effectively, in fact, I call the chapter "Greatness" toward the end because I think one of the definitions of greatness is to be able to say that you are wrong about something, or I didn't exactly get it right the first time, because 6 months later, then, Holmes writes a decision in November of 1919 and in another espionage law case in which he turns around what he said, or he tinkers with what he said in March of 1919, and instead of siding with the government and the espionage law, effectively, he says the most important thing here is the protection of free speech. So he intensifies the legal protections of free speech, kind of in response to his own opinion in the Debs case. So it's really interesting. It's one of the most beautiful opinions to come out of the Supreme Court. It's a dissenting opinion. And basically, he says the free trade of ideas is the way we get to the truth in a democracy. And so we have to listen to everyone, and everyone has to have the right to stand up and express their ideas. So, you know, too bad Eugene Debs wasn't, his case wasn't 6 months later, but at any rate, Holmes rethought that, and by the fall of 1919, we had, actually, that's one of the other events, David, that kind of shaped our the 20th century that came out of 1919. The notion of civil liberties came out of that struggle that year, because you know you don't really have a concept until there's a struggle that gives birth to it, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how we got the struggle for free speech and civil liberties as a kind of discipline and a notion in the law.
We're a bit past the midpoint here, and I just would like to again introduce the guest, Ann Hagedorn. She's an author, journalist. Her book is Savage Peace, Hope and Fear in America, 1919. And as you know, if you've been listening to the conversation, it concentrates on this one year in particular, this year that's wedged in between the beginning of the Roaring Twenties and the end of World War One, a year where a lot of interesting things were going on in this country, and the kinds of things that people were worried about, arguing about, concerned with, very much like the concerns that we have right now. The book is just out. It's published by Simon & Schuster. She's spending some time traveling around talking about the book. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Again, I think that it's interesting if you look at what's going on here. One of the issues that you've touched on, and maybe you can talk a little bit more, has to do with race and race relations. And we think about civil rights and the civil rights movement in this country. I think, again, probably people will mostly think about what was going on after what started to go on in this country after World War II, particularly in the 1960s. But I'm interested in hearing some more about how perhaps the civil rights movement in this country really does have roots that go back a little further, and that one of the important kind of forces that helped give some energy to demands by African Americans for greater civil rights did in fact have to do with the fact that they fought in World War One.
That's right. Oh, gosh. Well, just imagine fighting for a war that your president told you were fighting to make the world safe for democracy, and then you come back to your country and you find your race in the communities that your race lives in. There's still lynching. There's discrimination. There are issues of jobs. And not only that, there's little respect for what you did to make the world safe for democracy. So in other words, there was this hypocrisy that I mentioned earlier of there were two nations, basically. There was the nation where everyone, you know, peace was defined, I think, at that point in everyone's minds as democracy. You know, now we're at peace, and so now the world will be safe for democracy. So the African American soldiers came home. Their families expected. There were great expectations coming out of the war, and there were obviously huge disappointments. So I think that clash between expectation and disappointment that year helped to define a lot of the issues for the rest of the century. Not that those issues didn't already exist, but you know there were race riots in 26 cities in 1919. And the one of the most interesting details that I came across in my research, and including some really interesting characters in the book, involves that issue, because the response that we had to those race riots in this country was segregation. That was considered the solution, and that's how we got basically urban apartheid, or we got the black belts, right, in America's cities. And yet, during that year, part of the spy network that I mentioned earlier included something called the Negro Subversion Unit, which consisted of African-American agents shadowing African-Americans, especially big-time leaders like W.B. Du Bois. But by the summer, after a number of race riots, the head of those agents was asked to write a summary of what all the spies had learned by, you know, traveling secretly into African-American communities. And the result of that was a report that came out in August of 1919 that identified the problem as being segregation. and yet the it's a kind of another parallel between then and now, because in that report there's a mention of Bolshevism, but the government believed that it was Bolshevism that was causing the race riots. And Bolshevik influence, communist influence in the black communities is what they thought caused the race riots. Well, this wonderful man who it was looks like he's a villain because he's running this massive spy network, he puts together a very honest report in which he says, look, the problem isn't Bolshevism, it's segregation. But the report was buried. I found it one day in the National Archives, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was so stunningly on target, and it came out of military intelligence in August of 1919. 2 months later, the young J. Edgar Hoover was standing before Congress saying, the reason we have race riots in this country is because of communism. And that report was buried. So it was kind of a, you know, what they call cherry-picking of intelligence. But isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
And that story is in Savage Peace, and I just I found it just so surprising, something I didn't know. Here was this report that really laid it out, the problems of the reasons for unrest and the true reasons, and yet it never surfaced. In fact, I tried to see how far it went to see if it got to the office of, you know, the level of Wilson, but of course it didn't.
Let's talk with, there was a caller. I guess they changed their mind. Other people can call. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of the show. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You know, I think one of the things one of the things that I think is really interesting about this period is that, again, we think, when we think of, during the last century, when we think of times when there were great kind of cultural upheaval, of course, what people think of is the 60s. But what I think, again, is interesting is when you look at the kind of cultural issues people were debating then and perhaps still, again, you to follow the roots back, they actually go back before World War II, and that these are the kinds of things that people were really debating at this point that we're talking about, and that then somehow that, in a sense, that kind of debate gets knocked off the rails first by the Depression and then by World War II, when
That's
people
right.
were worried about, they had bigger stuff, I guess they would say, they had bigger stuff to worry about, first, survival in the sort of immediate sense during the Depression, and then this large, what was seen as being this large cosmic sort of good and evil battle that we were fighting in World War II. And that once we got through that, we got back to a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it raises interesting, these kinds of interesting what-if questions that people sit around debating at their leisure. What might America have looked like if, in a cultural sense, if the Depression and World War II had not happened?
Well, and also, if there's another what-if there, I think that's a really good question. And I think in writing 1919, I added a new what-if, which would have been, what if there had been a reconstruction plan after the war in the United States? What if there hadn't been so much fear? I mean, you have to put yourself in the shoes of people living in that year. This is not just the aftermath of a world war, but also of a flu pandemic that killed 50 million people worldwide, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very scary year. I mean, and so you have to put yourself in the place of people then, and so before you judge too harshly, but it was such a frightening time that I think when people are afraid, it's very hard to face the truth and to deal with reality.
Hmm.
And I kind of think that that's one of the things that happened, such intense instability that year. And that's another reason that it fascinates me, because then you have the people standing up and shouting the truth. That makes them all the more courageous and great, as, great Americans in our past. The Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, writing his dissent, and then W.B. Du Bois standing up after telling African Americans, go fight this war, and writing editorials saying we must support our country, and then writing an editorial in the NAACP magazine, The Crisis, in May of 1919. In fact, it was censored but at first. But he wrote one saying, we return fighting for our democracy at home. And so, you know, it's just a, it's a time of, a time when you can, I call it democracy under stress, but it's a time just like in the anti-slavery movement and the time before the Civil War, it's a time of instability and a lot of fear. And a lot of confusion about how to deal with what people must have known were serious issues. You know, you don't have 300 labor strikes a month and not recognize that there's a problem in your country. What's the simple way of dealing with it? Create a new enemy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if, the what if is, what if we had really approached some of those problems that year in a constructive way, then... you know, including what happened at the Paris Peace Conference, but at home, if we domestically, if we had approached some of those things in a more constructive way, instead of being so afraid of what of African Americans that we created, that we turned to segregation as the solution, then yeah, it really would have had a different outcome, I think. And if Wilson hadn't been so focused on his idealistic, you know, vision of the world, which, like I said, is very easy to get swept into. It's so magnificent. But if there had just been more attention to what do we do after, in the aftermath of war, to create stability in our own country, things would have been different.
Yeah. Let's go to another caller here. We have somebody. This is on a cell, I think, cell phone calling from around Fisher. This is line one. Hello.
I just wanted to thank the guests. I mean, this is all fascinating, interesting stuff you really don't learn about in our history classes in school. But I was just curious because I don't remember ever learning about blacks fighting in World War One. I mean, I knew they did a lot of cook and servant stuff and that they dug ditches.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's just something totally new to me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I know. Yeah, thank you for saying that. In fact, here's something else to add to your list. The first American soldier in France to win the French Medal of Honor, the Croix de Guerre, was African-American. A guy named, a Pullman porter from Albany, New York, his name was Sergeant Henry Lincoln Johnson.
Hmm.
And the actual fighting, you know, the 369th, they called them the Harlem Hellfighters, came out of New York. They were the, I think, 15th regiment of the New York Reserve, let's see, Guardsmen. And they went over the 369th Infantry and came back, the Harlem Hellfighters. And there's also another part of that, those troops was a man named James Reese Europe, Lieutenant James Reese Europe, very bright guy and a talented musician. And he is credited with bringing jazz to France. And that's another story, but yeah, there's a very big presence, and a wonderful. When you read the book, pay attention to the February. I think it's chapter 8, where when the black soldiers come home to New York, it's one of the most magnificent parades up Fifth Avenue in the history of the city. Very enthralling.
Yeah, it's just tremendously sad that how quickly the reaction became that these men who had gone in and fought for freedom and fought for the country, just how quickly they came to be seen as a threat.
Yeah, as a threat. Well, that's right. And like I probably said that earlier, that 11 African Americans in their uniforms were lynched.
Mm, uh-huh.
That year, but yeah, I think it was a threat. They were empowered, and I think in the bastions of racism in this country, that created a huge element of fear. right? Because here were these African Americans, they'd been carrying guns, and they were coming back empowered. And then there was the issue of mixed race marriages, because some were coming back married to French women they had met, and the French who were white, and so there was that fear, which is something that goes back, you know, to slavery times. I mean, very, I think fear is the main word, and so that's that clash of fear and hope, you know, sweeps through the year on a large scale, but in the African American narrative of the book and that part of the story of that year, it's very, very intense.
And this, I think that it's true, isn't it not true at this point that actually maybe for the first time in a number of states they actually moved to codify interracial marriage, that is to pass laws to make it illegal.
That's right. And that was another one of the struggles of the year. And actually, I bring that alive. You know, in narrative nonfiction, we don't tell things. I mean, you don't talk about things like you do in a typical academic work. It's showing things. It's a story, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I was going through all of the old newspapers of the time, I kept coming across these little paragraphs about a very wealthy woman from Boston who was trying to marry her African-American gardener. And it's a love story. It's an amazing story. So I decided at one point, well, I'm just going to spend a couple weeks to pursuing this just to see if I can dig up the records. And so that's how I tell that story. I found the trial transcripts, and it turned out to be a story that was on the front pages of the Boston newspapers every day for weeks and weeks and weeks, because it ended up being a very sensational trial. And I learned that those cases in which mixed marriage or attempts at mixed marriages during that period of time, they're usually filed under insanity cases. And so you don't find them because they're not considered race issues.
If someone wanted to marry somebody of another race, it was an indication that you were mentally ill.
Yeah, that's right. And so they're typically, and so, you know, Miss Puffer was declared insane, and so that case was filed under the under insanity cases, because that was the charge, and that was the outcome.
We have just maybe about 2 minutes, I think, as I said at the beginning, maybe you have to be a little bit careful about drawing parallels between one age and another and saying one time has lessons to teach us. But, you know, having said all that, I think your feeling is that, in fact, that perhaps looking at this time in America and the parallels between that time and our time does have something to teach us.
Oh, I think it does, and I don't, you know, I don't believe history repeats itself, but I think that issues that if we remain in denial about certain issues, that they will resurface during times of duress. And I also think that when you live in a democracy, it's not a clean-cut situation. I mean, it's not a clear, straight path to justice and equality. It's messy. It's painful. It's sometimes dangerous. It's a struggle. And I think when you it's marvelous, because if you live in a real democracy, as many of the characters in my book were seeking, then you have the right to stand up and say what you believe. And when that happens and it's not muzzled and it's not censored, then you get dialogue and debate, right? And so in a country like ours, which is magnificent, we have this these reoccurring times when there are struggles to keep democracy alive. And so I think that's that's why I think, you know, we have times that are mirror images of each other.
Yeah. Well, you've now done this book. Your last book, I think, was that the one that was about the Underground Railroad?
That was about the anti-slavery movement told through the narrative of one group of people that operated in Ohio and Indiana and lived along the Ohio River and helped assisted slaves on their journey to Canada, across the Ohio River up to Canada. Yeah, so yes, and there's a parallel there because those are people also who were bold enough to stand up for what they believed. They believed that slavery was wrong, and they had the courage to go against the popular current and say it was wrong. These are people that kind of fascinate me. You know, they devote themselves, they risk things in their lives to something larger than themselves. And I think we need to know about people like that. So there are a lot of those people in Savage Peace.
Mm. Well, I know that you're taking time to talk about the last project, and I'm sure that was something that consumed you a lot of your energy for a long time. Are you into something new, or do you have plans for what you would like to be doing next?
Well, I'm torn between two topics, and I haven't. I promised my editor that while I'm driving around promoting the book and sitting in airports and that in my spare moments I'll make a decision. So I haven't made a decision yet.
So you don't even want to say what those two things are?
No, I mean, oh, okay. If we had more time, I would describe them, and your listeners could vote on them for me.
Well,
I need to know the marketplace response. Yeah, no, they're both. They're both worthy subjects and with people that fascinate me, but I haven't been able to make a choice. So,
people will just have to be satisfied with what's in print right now.
That's right.
Go with that. And so with that, we will say thanks to our guest, Ann Hagedorn. The book, once again, that we're talking about here this morning, the book is titled Savage Peace, Hope and Fear in America, 1919, and it concentrates on this particular year and the things that were going on in America at that time. Very much the same concerns that we continue to worry about and think about and debate. The book is just recently published by Simon & Schuster. Ann Hagedorn has written for The Wall Street Journal. Her work has also appeared in The Washington Post. She taught writing at Northwestern and at Columbia University. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, David, this has been wonderful. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. The show was originally broadcast in April. Many of our past shows, those from Focus 580, Afternoon Magazine, a lot of our local programming available on our website. And you can listen anytime that you like. It's WILL.UIUC.EDU. Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. In the next hour, we'll be taking your calls about insects. May Barenbaum will be here. First, though, we will pause for news and update on the market, so please stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Bastifer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade in the corn pit. We're seeing some very bearish technical signals this morning as the trade continues to factor in weekend rains as well as projections for rains later this week across the Corn Belt. Within the last 5 minutes, we see that July corn futures dipped below its 200.